From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You've listened to reggae, but have you heard mento? Mento is Jamaican music that predates reggae. On today's Fresh Air, a concert of mento by the Jolly Boys, a Jamaican band that's played for decades. Also, Sonny Bono tells us why they laughed at him. It's the second half of our conversation, focusing today on the Sonny and Cher years. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A judicial report in Israel into the killing by police last October of 17 Palestinians in Jerusalem has largely contradicted the findings of an official inquiry that was conducted soon after the incident. The shootings took place in an area of Jerusalem known to Jews as the Temple Mount and to Muslims as the Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest Muslim shrine. The BBC's Alex Brody reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli government has always maintained that police opened fire because Jewish worshippers at the Western Wall were in mortal danger from stones hurled down on them by Arab rioters. The judge, however, finds a different sequence of events. He finds that when the stones were thrown, most of the worshippers at the wall had already fled. And he said what sparked the stone-throwing attack on police was the unprovoked explosion of a tear gas grenade, which he said was accidentally dropped by a policeman. It rolled away and exploded near a group of Muslim women. That ignited Arab anger and the police response, which eventually got out of hand. The police have been accused of firing indiscriminately. The judge said police behavior was in some cases improper, but he did not recommend pressing charges against any individual policeman.
The BBC's Alex Brody. Riot police in Athens used tear gas today to break up demonstrations by students and others protesting President Bush's visit to Greece. Officials said that several thousand protesters fought with police, defying a ban on demonstrations during the president's visit. The students attempted to march on the Greek parliament, where Mr. Bush was speaking, and on the U.S. embassy. They were protesting American foreign policy in the Mediterranean. The Senate passed compromise legislation today designed to quell the fears of the American public that the AIDS virus is being transmitted by doctors to patients. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, such fears are unjustified. The CDC knows of only five patients who it believes got the AIDS-causing virus from a health professional. But senators proposed a bill to block criminal penalties suggested by North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms. Helms proposed to sentence health care workers who don't disclose they have the virus to 10 years in jail. Senator Dave Durenberger.
Do you think any one of these people who have what is already a fatal disease are going to be deterred by the threat of a long jail term? Come on. They're already terminal.
The Helms Amendment passed 81 to 18. The compromise, which would require infected health care workers to stop performing certain procedures, also passed 99 to 0, leaving a final decision on how to deal with doctors who have the disease up to later negotiations between the Senate and the House. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 37 points to close at 3,016. This is NPR. A terrorist group in Lebanon sent a photograph of American hostage Terry Anderson to a news agency in Beirut today. And the photo was accompanied by a statement in Arabic implying that Anderson would be harmed if Germany does not free two Arab brothers who've been convicted of terrorism. The statement came from a pro-Iranian group known as the Islamic Jihad. It referred to two Shiite Muslim brothers who are being held in German prisons. One of the brothers was slightly injured in a prison fight earlier this week. The German government has said it will not release the two brothers. Vietnam insisted today that it's not holding any Americans against their will, despite a photo that purports to show three Americans who were listed as missing in action during the Vietnam War. The Vietnamese government says one of the men pictured is dead and that his remains were returned to the United States last year. The Pentagon says it can't make a positive identification. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Hanoi says the remains of Air Force Colonel John Layton Robertson were turned over to the U.S. in April 1990, 1 month before what may be the date of the grainy photo that shows three men, one of whom family members have identified as Robertson. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says Vietnam turned over the remains of 10 missing servicemen to the U.S. last year, but so far the Pentagon has been able to identify only one. Defense Department officials continue to analyze the photo, but say privately they have doubts about its authenticity. A U.S. State Department official is now in Asia, and plans are being made for him to visit Hanoi and other Southeast Asian capitals to investigate the photograph. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The Pentagon announced that it has found 7 military satellites that were launched into the wrong orbit today by a Pegasus rocket that veered off course. The communications satellites were found in an orbit only half as high as they were intended to be. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you think of Jamaican music, you probably think of reggae. We're about to hear a concert of Jamaican music that predates reggae. It's called Mento, and it's a lot like calypso. My guests are the 4 members of the Jolly Boys, a group that's performed for decades in Jamaica. Only one founding member remains with the band, banjo player Moses Dean, who's now in his 70s. For the past decade, the Jolly Boys have performed for tourists at a hotel in Port Antonio, Jamaica. A couple of years ago, rock songwriter Jules Shear was vacationing at that hotel and got hooked on the Jolly Boys' music. He got them signed to the independent record company First Warning. The company has just released the Jolly Boys' 2nd record, Sunshine and Water. The band had never played outside Jamaica before they made their first record. This summer, the Jolly Boys are touring America, performing in rock clubs and at music festivals. A little later, I'll talk with the group's leader and spokesperson, drummer Alan Swimmer. So here we go, the Jolly Boys in concert from the Fresh Air Studio.
Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born, man, bam, bam. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born, where the green bananas grow and the Rio Grande flow. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born. Take me back to the island in the sun, amen. Take me back to that sunny land of funds, where we all can sit and dine, and have fun in the sunny, sunny land of mine. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born. Where we all can sit and dine and have fun in the sunny, sunny land of mine. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born, where the green bananas grow on the Rio Grande flow. Take me back to Jamaica, where I were born. Jamaica, where I were born.
And that's the Jolly Boys, a group from Jamaica, performing for us today on Fresh Air. And the leader of the group, who was also the lead vocalist and the bongo player, is Alan Swimmer. And Alan, I want to welcome everybody again.
to Fresh Air. Can you explain to us what the difference is between Mento, the music you play, and Calypso?
I know. That's a good point. You see, the Caribbean, all over the Caribbean, is the same people, the same African people that they brought there, the same sons and daughters of them, with the same sound, but the different islands have different names to the rhythm. Now, in Jamaica, the name of the music in my father and grandfather's days was Mento. In, like, Trinidad, it was Calypso. Right now, they call it Soca. Just like how we grew up and said reggae, because, you know, there was a change there. Everybody, I think what happens is improvement. People get new instruments and new ideas about using instruments. So we change our style until we reach thus far. But that's the main thing about it, is just the different names that the different Caribbean islands had for their rhythms in the older days.
Did people start losing interest in Mento after reggae came along?
Yes, but that didn't stop the Mento from going. I'll tell you something about this Mento music. If you go into the hotels in Jamaica now, you'll find these bands.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing. For one thing, we are more portable, easier to move around. And another thing, if power cuts, which do happen sometimes, there, we still play. We don't have to wait for our current to play.
The next song you're going to do for us is Crying Time, which is a song a lot of us know from Ray Charles' recording.
That's right.
Tell me how you know the song and how you started performing it.
Well, you see, I am very easy to learn songs. I learned most of these songs from the radios and the jukebox. Once I heard a song and I love it, I punch it, I listen to it, and I go home. I think on it when I wake in the morning. I have certain amount of it. If I don't get all, I go back and I punch it. So it's like I know from school to church to this kind of music, I know a real good amount of songs. And I know them straight through. So you see, I'm very easy to learn songs. And so I just listen to the radio because I love it. I listen to it. Then I let it go deep down into me. So it stays, you know, somewhere in the subconscious mind. I don't know, but it's there.
Let me ask you to play Crying Time for
okay,
us.
Yes. Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna leave me. I can see that faraway look in your eyes. I can tell it by the way you hold me, darling, that it won't be long before it's crying time. Now you say you find someone that you love better. That's the way it happens every time before. But as sure as the sun comes up tomorrow, crying time will start when we walk through the door. That it won't be long before it's crying time.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Were you able to get American radio in Jamaica?
Mm-hmm.
So you hear a lot of like the American hits. And
that's right. And we have the records on the radio station. You know,
right.
All the records.
So you get the records on the Jamaican radio station.
That's right. So, you know, you tune in to JBC or RJR, and you listen a program like Bobby Dree program, and, you know, whoever, you get the songs. You get Jamaican songs, you get American songs, English, Spanish if you wanted to.
Well, we have to take a short break, so let's do that, and then we'll hear more of a concert with the Jolly Boys, a group from Jamaica who has two recent albums, one brand new and one from a couple of years ago. And the albums are called Pop and Mento and Sunshine and Water. This is Fresh Air. Featuring a concert with the Jolly Boys, a group from Jamaica. And I've also been speaking with the leader of the group, Alan Swimmer, who's also featured on repeater drums and lead vocals. The other members of the band are Moses Dean on banjo. He's a founding member of the group. Noel Howard on guitar, Joseph Bennett on the thumb piano, which he, by the way, made himself. And everybody in the group sings backup vocals as well. Alan, you want to introduce another song for us?
Oh, yes. Right now, we are going to do Back to Back and Belly to Belly.
This is going to change the mood a little bit,
that's
isn't it?
That's right. Back into the Mento style, you know? The wiggling style. Yeah, you know, you bubble up for this one. Yes, you have to. Man, it was a zombie zambari that took place in a New York cemetery. It was a zombie zambari that took place in a Woodlawn cemetery. Zombie from all parts of the island, some of them were real Calypsonians. Since the season was carnival, so they get together with Bacchanal. And they're singing back to back, belly to belly. Well, I don't hear a damn for a damn, they're ready. Back to back, belly to belly, what a zombie zambari. Hear the chorus, back to back, belly to belly. Well, I don't hear a damn for a damn, they're ready. Back to back, belly to belly, what a zombie zambari. Zombie feet, zombie raise one finger to one. Mister, take care, you mash my corn. The funniest thing I could ever see, a zombie eating catfish and fancy. I never see my mabi, a ginger beer than a the zombie parade which took place last year. They singing back to back, belly to belly. Well, I don't hear a damn for a damn, they're ready. Back to back, belly to belly, what a zombie zambari. Hear the chorus, back to back, belly to belly. Well, I don't hear a damn for a damn, they're not ready. Back to back, belly to belly, what a zombie zambari, man.
So, Ellen, who wrote this lyric about a zombie jamboree?
I'll tell you something. It's inherited. Ever since I was growing, I heard this song in Jamaica. So I really don't. I think it's John Williams or one of those early writers. of Minto songs.
Ellen, a couple of the instruments in the band are handmade. You made your drum, and the African thumb piano that we're hearing, which is actually in a big box. I think people are used to like small thumb pianos, but this is a this is in a box the size of an amplifier, a guitar amplifier. It's hollowed out, and it's got a wooden cover with a circle in the middle, kind of like a guitar sounding board. And it's got metal keys over that, which you press and which has this really nice bass sound.
Yes.
You want to just play a few notes for us on the piano? Yeah, it's a great sound.
Yeah.
Very unique sound. Well, let me ask you to do another song for us.
Oh, yes. Why not? This one is Spicy, Nicey, Juicy Watermelon.
Who wrote this? Did you write this? Or
no,
is this another?
It's another
traditional song.
Traditional song. So, India Gangstar, me tell you, man. We are at Fresh Air, man. The Jolly Boys, live and direct. Spicy, Nicey, Juicy Watermelon.
Watermelon, it is the biggest and the best in Africa, this thing really is a lovely sight. And she told me that when she goes to Africa, she's gonna have a little slice each night.
Oh,
that
lovely
watermelon, sweet watermelon, baby, yes. Spicy, nicey, juicy watermelon. I'm gonna have a little slice each night. I'm bound to have a little slice each night. Man, I'm bound to have a little slice each night. Hey, man, cha cha cha.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. It's hard to sit still when you're listening to this music.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
As you travel around the United States and you've been to Japan, are you picking up more songs that you didn't know before?
Well, I tell you, not even songs like music. For instance, the African styling of music. I never had the opportunity of hearing them in Jamaica, except for those that are there. And when I get to Harbourfront in Canada, I get the first time I get to meet with the Africans, men like the three brothers, Thomas Mafumo, and men like those, you know. And I get a taste of what African music is like, you understand? I even think I'm going to try to do some of that kind of music along the way, too.
Tell us a thing or two about everybody in the band.
About everybody in the band?
Yeah.
Well, I think all of us are very hardworking people, because when we finish playing the music, we couldn't confine to playing the music in the nights alone. We have to go, like, planting something to eat, you know, to back up what you make as money from the hotel. All of us have our little kitchen garden that we provide, like our own bananas and plantains and yams. And we have more ground food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we are very hardworking people, all of us, you see here.
Now, I hear that before you put out your first record, you'd never heard the group recorded before. Is that right?
I have done a song with Byron Lee at Byron Lee's studio before. But I didn't get anywhere with it because I'd need more money,
right,
was to push it. So it's always been my ambition, but never have the money, because in Jamaica, it's not as easy to do a recording in Jamaica like here. You have to have a lot of money, because most of our stuff that we use, like these, are imported stuff. So there was a lot of tax go for them.
Right. Well, I want to thank you all for performing. It's been a really enjoyable concert, a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I wish you the best, and thanks very much.
Thank you very much, too.
And performing has been the Jolly Boys, a group from Jamaica. And they have a couple of albums I should tell you about. One is called Pop and Mento. Their new album is called Sunshine and Water. And you can find these records on First Warning, distributed by Ryko Disc. And the Jolly Boys are on a tour of the United States, and in the next few weeks they'll be heading to Portland, Santa Barbara, Chicago, Minneapolis, Dayton, Columbus, and Charleston, among other cities, so you might watch out for them if you're in those areas. And thank you again. Let me ask you to play us out.
Thank you again for having us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the days of I Got You, Babe, and The Beat Goes On, Sonny and Cher were the showbiz version of the counterculture couple. Coming up in part two of our conversation, Sonny Bono remembers the era of Sonny and Cher. That and more on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Violence marked the first day of a visit to Greece by President Bush. Police clashed with protesters near a building where the president and Mrs. Bush were having dinner with Greek officials. Tasia Kavadias reports from Athens.
Rioting broke out when several thousand demonstrators, mostly students, defied a national order banning public gatherings today. Riot police in full force hurled tear gas into crowds just minutes away from where the president dined. Many of the demonstrators carried Cypriot flags and chanted slogans demanding Turkey's withdrawal from the neighboring island. Earlier in the day, during a press conference, Mr. Bush had complimented Turkish President Turgut Özal and urged the two nations to put aside their differences. Greek resentment lingers over the 1974 Turkish invasion of Cyprus, and many feel that was an aggression that warranted the same American reaction that followed the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. For National Public Radio, I'm Tasia Kavadias in Athens.
Secretary of State James Baker says that the United States and Syria have now agreed on terms for a Middle Eastern peace conference, with the Bush administration agreeing to a UN observer who would take notes and communicate with those involved in the peace talks. This announcement was made after talks today between Baker and Syrian officials in Damascus and would appear to now put pressure on Israel to decide whether or not to go along. Israel has objected to UN intervention in the past. Baker is now on his fifth trip to the Middle East in efforts to get peace talks started. Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy has been invited to visit Cairo in the next couple of weeks. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Foreign Minister Levy has long been hoping for an invitation to Cairo. Egyptian Foreign Minister Amr Moussa extended the invitation for the end of July. He said Egypt is holding extensive contacts with Syria, the United States, and Palestinian leaders, and it is in this context that Egypt has invited the Israeli Foreign Minister. Egypt is the only Arab country that has a peace treaty with Israel, but relations between the two states have been cool, and no senior Israeli government officials have been invited to Egypt in years. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has said he will meet Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir if Shamir promises to make concessions toward peace with the Arab states. Israeli officials hope that Levy's visit to Cairo will help improve the atmosphere between the two countries. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In Yugoslavia, the country's collective presidency has reportedly agreed to pull all Federal Army troops out of Slovenia. A Serbian spokesman made no mention of the future of an estimated 70,000 federal troops in neighboring Croatia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 37 points to close at 3,016.32. This is NPR News. A group said to be holding two Western hostages in Lebanon has released a picture of Terry Anderson and warned of what it called grave consequences if two brothers convicted of terrorism are not released from German prisons. The Islamic Jihad sent a statement to the Beirut office of a Western news agency along with a photograph of Anderson. The statement charged that the German prisoners are being mistreated. The black-and-white picture showed Anderson wearing a sweater and looking up and slightly away from the camera. There was no indication when the picture was taken. German officials said that they would not be put under pressure. In Washington, as President Bush's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Judge Clarence Thomas, made the rounds of Capitol Hill again today, there was a heated public debate between his supporters and opponents in Congress. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today, Republican lawmakers in the House and Senate complained about the treatment Thomas was getting in the media, and they accused Thomas's opponents of a mean-spirited insistence on ideological conformity. Members of the Black Caucus, who voted overwhelmingly last week to oppose Thomas, today explained their opposition, saying that Thomas's record shows he would not uphold the legacy of Thurgood Marshall, the Supreme Court justice whose seat Thomas has been nominated to fill. Members of the Black Caucus say Thomas has questioned the wisdom of the Brown versus Board of Education anti-segregation decision and that he would work to dismember it if he were on the court. Thomas's chief sponsor in the Senate, Missouri Republican John Danforth, disputed that claim, saying Thomas agreed with the Brown decision but thought it would have been stronger if it had been based on different legal arguments. Senate hearings on Thomas's nomination begin in the fall. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar was up sharply against other major currencies. Gold prices were up. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. In the era of Sonny and Cher, Sonny Bono had a solo hit called Laugh at Me. A lot of people laughed at Sonny after the duo broke up because Cher went on to become a superstar while Sonny seemed to be washed up. And some people laughed when he ran for mayor of Palm Springs, another celebrity politician, but he won by a wide margin. Yesterday on Fresh Air, we learned there was a lot more to Sonny Bono's rock and roll resume than Sonny and Cher. In his early career, he co-wrote the great song Needles and Pins. He was a producer at the R&B label Specialty Records, and he worked with the most important producer in rock and roll history, Phil Spector. Coming up in the second part of our conversation, the Sonny and Cher years, when they first laughed at Sonny because of his outrageous clothes.
Can I be like any guy? Why do they try to make me run? Son of a gun, now what do they care about the clothes I wear? Why get their kicks from making fun? So I don't care. Then laugh at me if that's the fair. I have to pay to be free. Then baby, laugh at me.
Well, you had been used to marketing other performers, and here you were trying to like produce and market your yourself. What image did you want as a couple? How much of who you were as performers was like conscious marketing?
Well, there was a tremendous hook with dressing the way we did. I mean, I took Phil's idea and went into a packaged it more in a commercial fashion, and so we went even more obvious than Philip did, and we found these bobcat vests. We would have our bell bottoms made with just wild fabrics, and we were kind of unisex, both of us, and it had this real strong look, and our timing was perfect because, as I say, up until then, everything was a standard. So when we would go to a concert, people may not even have known who we were, but then when they saw us, they loved it, and it just caught on. The whole package caught on.
Now, you wrote and produced most of the Sonny and Cher records.
Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as having used production techniques that you learned when you were working with Phil Spector?
Yeah, I think both. I think I learned one facet from Specialty. I mean, that was a great teaching ground as well. And then the real commercial aspect from Phil Spector. Yeah, Phil had a handle on what was commercial and how to write commercial songs. I really wasn't able to crystallize it the way Phil did until I met Phil. Then I had like this cognition about music that I had never had before. And once that occurred, I understood what he was attempting and so was able to go for that same goal.
What's the record of the records that you and Cher made together that you still like most, for the songwriting, the performance, or the production, all of the above?
Okay, Gosh, there were a few that I thought were really, really exceptional. I thought I Got You, Babe was the moment that I produced it. I knew it was a hit. All this music balanced perfectly. The hook with the bassoon and oboe worked perfectly. So it was a tricky production that worked well. The most difficult production that I ever had was Bang Bang, not Bang Bang, You Better Sit Down, Kids, because that I'll remember all my musicians were the same guys, and they'd come in to see what we were going to do, and when they heard You Better Sit Down, Kids, the way it was structured, going from 4-4 to 7-8 time, you know, they went, what is he doing? And so, but again, as it rolled out beautifully. And then using a gypsy violin with Bang Bang, I liked all those productions. I liked all those hooks. They were a real stretch, but they laid in right in that commercial vein.
You heard Sinatra's recording of Bang Bang, right?
Yeah, I did. I wish you would have put some tempo on it.
Sonny Bono's my guest. He's written an autobiography called And the Beat Goes On. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Sonny Bono is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography. It's called And the Beat Goes On. Sonny and Cher went through its high points and low points as a duo. What was the low point, and what was the most like horrible type of place to play?
The low point was kind of where you get ashamed, or I got ashamed of myself anyway, was, you know, achieving all this success as a musical act. And then letting it slip away to almost oblivion, you know. And so it was a real low point for me. I didn't know how to recover from it. And I didn't know what to do. Music had taken a left turn and gone in a totally different direction. And I couldn't philosophically hook up with it. And so I wasn't able to produce that kind of music. So I was kind of lost there, and that was absolutely the low point for us.
When was this?
That was about 1967. Actually, things went on the wane. After about 66, things started turning the other way, and I think I wanted us to get into movies and things, and I don't know if I concentrated enough in music. I probably lost the interest that I had prior to this success. And so I wasn't writing the songs the way I was writing when I was really hungry. And then music itself changed, so it was real hard to get back into the scene again. And eventually, we just couldn't get into it. So our market was gone. It was absolutely gone, and we were very cold. And so the only choice open to us then was to work nightclubs in hotels. There was still a nightclub circuit. Didn't pay very well. It would just keep you afloat, but at least you stayed in the business. And we did that. And now here we were working to thousands of kids, working to a couple hundred people in a nightclub audience. And it was way more intimate, way more scary. And Cher didn't like it at all because of the intimacy. And so she would avoid working directly with the audience. And sometimes both of us would, and that's so we started that repartee, just to kind of keep our spirits up on stage. It was sort of a oh well screw 'em attitude, you know. Let's just be us. So we would tease each other, and it caught on, and So we continued with that, and as it caught on, it became more and more sophisticated and got incorporated into the act. And then a CBS executive, Fred Silverman, saw us at the Americana Hotel and gave us a summer show, and that was, and we were back on the scene again.
When you and Cher split up, I'll let the personal differences go, but what were some of the performing and musical differences between you?
I don't think we had musical differences. The only differences, the only thing that we had that was different was Cher never really wanted to do, Cher always wanted to be a rock singer, rock and roll, hard rock and roll singer, and she still does, I think, today. And it just isn't her cup of tea. So I think in some sense, Sonny and Cher were corny for her after a while. They weren't at first, not right as we started, but later on she leaned more towards that rock and roll, and she had an incredible desire to go into that direction.
Why did you have a hard time keeping in the music business after you and Cher split up?
Why did I have a hard time staying? I had a hard time staying in anything after Cher and I split up. I think part of what the show did was, although I don't believe it, and I will always defend this, it was kind of like, well, Cher is the talented one and Sonny is like the doofus. But that image, I think, went across to America. And so when Sonny and Cher split up, Cher had more attraction and attention in the industry, and they just dropped me, period. So nobody was in when the phone rang, and I just couldn't get into the industry at all. And to compound it, I really didn't want to let go of Sonny and Cher, and talk about confused. I guess that was the most confused time, because I didn't know anything else other than the industry, so I didn't know what to do, and I kept pursuing it, and the more I pursued it, the less response I got. And finally, the only thing that you can do in that business when you were once somebody and then not somebody is you can work a lot of love boats. So I think I held the record on Love Boat, and I'll never forget one day I was doing Fantasy Island, same producer, Aaron Spelling. So I do Love Boats and Fantasy Islands, and I'm sitting in a trailer, and I'm going, what am I doing? I said, you're either on your way up or your way down. So it was very, very depressive. You know, it wasn't as glamorous as I wanted it to be or as it's supposed to be, because you're really on your way down. And I think when I called Hervé Pontoon in my scene, I forget what his name was, but it wasn't Pontoon. God sent me a message. Get out of there.
It must have been especially aggravating to not be able to stay in the music business since you'd been the writer and the producer of all the records.
Yeah, I never didn't believe in my ability or my talent, so it was aggravating in that, well, wait a minute, you know, don't you know I'm talented too? And so that message just wouldn't come across, and the more you tried to pitch it, the less it came across. If I was in the same frame of mind that I am now, what I would have done and should have done is you just start right back at the bottom, and I probably could have worked my way up in a year or two and been fine. But having been on top, you want to kind of start where you're at, and you're not there anymore. So it's a Don Quixote kind of thing, you know. You're chasing windmills.
How did you end up getting into politics after music?
Politics... Well, the first thing that I had to do was I had to let go of Sonny and Cher, let go of the career, let go of all of that, and just be okay with me again. And then eventually I did start at the bottom. I opened a restaurant, and I was a busboy, a cook, everything. And I was the happiest I had been again, because I was creating my own actions. So no matter what it was. And when I let go of Sonny and Cher, my wife came into the picture, and we were having a good time. We moved down to Palm Springs. I had a home there for 17 years, and I wanted to get into business there, and I dealt with the city, and they seemed incredibly illogical to me about a lot of things. I needed a sign, and I was remodeling the house, and they weren't nice about it. And we would have these silly arguments about nothing, and I said, don't you realize you're holding back the growth of this town? And so then they red-tagged me because I was being a smart mouth to them. So then I went and talked to the mayor, and I said, look, mayor, you need this kind of thing in your town. And he was very nice about it, but they still didn't respond. So I said, well, I'm going to run for mayor then. And so I ran, and I didn't really stay stuck on my own particular issues, but I did start to notice that the town was sliding backwards, and that I felt it was moving in the wrong direction, and that it needed to be brought up into a contemporary period. So I got dedicated to it, and I enjoyed it. And so I landed on my feet in Palm Springs as a mayor.
Sonny Bono has written an autobiography called And the Beat Goes On. Who knows, there may be a Sonny Bono revival in the works. There's a forthcoming record called Bonograph, featuring up-and-coming rock bands interpreting Sonny's songs. We have an advance copy, so let's hear what the Frampton Brothers do with Sonny's song Bang Bang.
And she was six, rode on horses made of sticks. She wore black, I wore white. She would always win the fight. Bang, bang, she shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Lots of news tonight, and these features. We'll talk with NPR's Daniel Zwertling about continuing riots at schools in Kenya, rioting there in protest about conditions in the schools. 19 girls, for example, were killed by male students at one school on Saturday. A pair of bicycle designers join us from San Francisco. Their company is called Carbon Works, and they've built the bicycle that the American Greg LeMond is riding this year in the Tour de France. Also, a discussion of city slogans in the state of Wisconsin, including the birthplace of the ice cream sundae, the home of the big fiberglass animals, and home of Susie the Duck.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language is constantly changing, but linguist Jeff Nunberg says it can be poignant to watch a particularly colorful word headed for obscurity.
When I was in my teens, I always had this clear picture of how it was going to be. She was going to look like Jean Arthur or Barbara Stanwyck, and at a certain point, she was going to stamp her pretty little foot and look up at me and say, "You big galoot, can't you see I'm crazy about you?" Only I grew up too short and too late. My frame is not what you'd call galootish, and anyway, the word was all but extinct by the time I reached my majority. I'm not one of those people who fear for the state of Western civilization every time the language changes, but I'll miss galoot, and I'm kind of puzzled it's gone. Sometimes a word has to be put out to pasture when it's outlived its usefulness. I have a certain nostalgia for antimacassar, furbelow, and poop deck on purely phonetic grounds, but I can see that it would have been impractical to try to keep them around. And other words are predestined to burn out after brief meteoric careers. It's not surprising you don't hear groovy and far out anymore. Words like those are the Nancy Sinatras and Tommy Sands of the English lexicon. But galoot has been doing quiet, useful work for more than 100 years, and it isn't as if there was suddenly nothing more to apply it to. The woods are still full of galoots, Randy Quaid, Roger Clemens, John Kenneth Galbraith, only now we have to find something else to call them. It isn't just slang words this happens to. Whatever became of dudgeon, meaning indignation, as in the sentence, "The roacher stomps back to the dugout in high dudgeon." This one has been around since the mid-16th century, and then it seems suddenly to have vanished, like someone who stepped out to buy a pack of cigarettes in August of 1952 and was never heard from again. And where did geegaw go after 700 years of honorable service? Or chum, which has been around since Dryden's time? Just think of the publisher that reissues all of the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books, having to hire legions of editors whose job it is to scratch out every occurrence of chum and replace it with friend or pal. When I checked these words in the dictionary, I found they shared a curious property. Galoot, dudgeon, geegaw, and chum are all marked with the haunting phrase of obscure origin. Lexicographers like to speculate about where they came from, of course, and you can always find some word in another language that sounds like the word you're interested in. Eric Partridge thought that galoot might have come from the Dutch word galoot, meaning eunuch, but he had no evidence for the connection and no account of why that word should turn up in English meaning an oafish fellow. Or maybe it's from the French galut, meaning glutton. You can make up your own story about this one. This is what makes etymology such an entertaining pastime, but with some words, there's simply no way to tell where they came from. I think of these as Heathcliff words. They're these dark strangers that show up on the doorstep one day to claim their place in the linguistic household. Some of them are sent to sleep in the barn, like galoot. Others, like dudgeon, plop themselves down brazenly at the dinner table. Yet there's always something a little different about them. And maybe it's foreordained that one day they should slip away just as mysteriously as they arrived. Will they come back as ghosts then? Words do that sometimes. Take swell. It's been a generation or two since the word was last used in earnest, but people do still say it ironically. That's a swell idea, as if to say, "Where are you coming from, 1940? It would make a nicely romantic ending for the story. Someday I'll look up and glimpse the spirits of galoot and dudgeon gliding over the moor like Heathcliff and Kathy.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. If you have comments about Fresh Air, call us on our new toll-free line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurruck, and Sue Weinstein. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
One of this summer's most compelling movie performances is Samuel Jackson as a crack addict named Gator in Spike Lee's movie Jungle Fever. We'll talk with Jackson on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.